Well, good evening, everyone. It's my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's event. As you can see, it's part of Biology Week 2013. So thanks to everyone at the Society of Biology who's we've organised this event in partnership with, as you can see from the lovely banner behind you. My name's Martin Davis. I'm just going to say a very quick words about the Royal Institution. So anyone not been to the Royal Institution before? Put your hand up. Quite a few of you. So just to fill you in, we were founded in 1799 with twin aims, the first aim being scientific research. So 14 Nobel Prize winners have been based here, and 10 chemical elements were discovered in our basement, and good chemical elements as well, like sodium and chlorine and ones you've heard of. You can check, it's all down in the museum downstairs, so do go and take a look at that if you've got a bit of time. And the other reason we're founded, we're the world's first science communication organisation. So ever since we were founded, there have been talks, debates, lectures, all on subjects related to science, and we continue that tradition today. You've been seeing some of the events we've got coming up rolling around behind me, so do visit rogb.org and check out some of those if you want to come along to something else. And finally, just a little bit of housekeeping, so just make sure all your electronic devices, tablets, phones, whatever it is you've got, are set to silent just so they don't disturb our speakers. But absolutely fine to be tweeting, Facebooking, MySpacing, whatever it is you do, to do all that. And remember, as you can see, you may have seen in the background, the RI is at RI_science if you want to follow us. And the hashtag for this event is going to be RI Live. So do send us your comments, thoughts, opinions, and so forth. Well, anyway, that's enough about me and the RI. It's my pleasure to hand over to your host for tonight, which is the Telegraph's Ian Douglas. Thanks. Cheers.
Thank you, Martin. Good evening, and welcome again to the Royal Institution. The Royal Institution. This place, it's written all over the walls. Not in here so much, but outside. Science lives here. Science, you can put the emphasis anywhere you like in that sentence. Science lives here. We have scientists all over the building. But they know, 14 Nobel Prize winners, they all knew that their discoveries didn't really come to full fruition until they told people about it, until they came to this room and told people like you all about what they'd done. Science lives here, right here, where we're sitting, where you're sitting. Science is the most important factor shaping our modern world, and tonight's subject couldn't be closer to the way that science and society meets and interfaces. It's fundamental to questions of freedom and justice. And live issues that are discussed in courtrooms and prisons every day between ourselves. Tonight's speakers, we have three speakers. Robin McKenzie, Professor of Law at Kent University, distinguished author of a huge number of papers on neuroscience, ethics and medicine. Thomas Baldwin, Professor of Philosophy at the University of York, the editor of the journal Mind, and has worked extensively on bioethics in committee and publications, and Jonathan Pettit of the Pettit Genetics Laboratory at the University of Aberdeen as a group leader and reader in genetics at their Institute of Medical Science. Now, they're going to speak in turn, and then at the end, we're going to have questions. There will be many, many questions, I'm sure, but let's get started. Robin. Oh, sorry, Jonathan.
Okay. So, it may surprise you to know, but behavioural genetics has already been used in the law courts twice, once in the US and once in Italy. And in both cases, the defence used genetics, or the presence of a specific gene, to reduce the sentence. In both cases, the sentence was murder, and in both cases, the sentence was reduced. Okay, now it wasn't diminished responsibility, but nevertheless, the sentence was affected by the genetics of the defendant. Now, they're both defended using the same gene. It's a gene called monoamine oxidase. Monoamine oxidase it encodes a rather boring protein, which breaks down the neurotransmitters, lots of different neurotransmitters in our brains. Now, the reason why we got to this state actually starts in the Netherlands. So there's a family which appeared to have an inherited predisposition towards rather nasty forms of violent criminal activity. Now, as you can imagine, that sounds a bit iffy. Nevertheless, it appeared to pan out in terms of the genetics. So the researcher involved, Hans Brunner at the University of Nijmegen, was able to map the mutation and to localize it to a specific gene, which was the gene monoamine oxidase. And the males in this family all completely lacked the gene. The gene was essentially missing. So they were unable to make monoamine oxidase A. And this made huge impact. It came out in Science, as I say, in the 80s. And that really started the monoamine oxidase bandwagon going. And I've chosen monoamine oxidase as a story because it's actually the best case that we have for linking a particular variation in a gene to a particular human behavioral trait. Okay, and I hope, as you'll see, that the evidence is not that great. Okay, and it's our best case scenario. Okay, so fast forward a number of years, people start looking, is there variation, is there natural variation? Because the individuals, the Dutch individuals, they were missing the gene. I mean, and they also had behavioral abnormalities, as you might imagine if you were unable to break down the neurotransmitters in your brain. So these are pathological conditions. But is there natural variation? Is there variation in this gene in the population? And researchers found there was. There's technicalities about it, which I could easily go into for probably more than an hour. But the important thing is that there seem to be two variants, a so-called low variant, which has some activity but not high, and the high variant. Now, there are caveats even with this, but we'll just gloss over those. So people then started looking, can we associate this variation in this gene with behavioral traits, in particular, obviously, aggression, because that's how it was first found. And there's been lots of studies, not just looking at aggression, looking at risk-taking and various other elements. The best study came out in 2002. It was Caspi et al., and this was also a Science paper. And it was looking at a population survey, a large-scale population survey in New Zealand, the so-called Dunedin genetic survey. What is it? Dunedin, sorry. Pronunciation. What they were able to show was that, yes, you could link a particular variant, the low variant of monoamine oxidase, to aggression, but only if the individuals concerned had experienced significant trauma, childhood trauma, so abuse, an abusive environment. Otherwise, there didn't seem to be a linkage. More strikingly, because several people have subsequently tried to replicate this, this only appears to be true of Caucasian, European, and American populations, obviously New Zealand population originally. Okay, it's not replicable in other ethnic groups. Now, this is normal. This is exactly what we expect to find in human population genetics. We often find that you can identify a positive and real statistical signal, but only in a certain population, and that statistical signal vanishes when you move to another population. Okay, and that could be because the genetics changes, the genetic background changes, or it could be that the environment changes. It's probably both. Okay, because I think one of the things that's often underappreciated when we're thinking about genetics is that it isn't a case of the genetics versus the environment. It's never been like that. It's never been nature versus nurture. Okay, the two things essentially blend together, and they're almost impossible to disentangle. And I find it easiest when I'm teaching students about population genetics, I find it easiest to actually explain it in terms of extremes. In fact, I find it most easiest to explain most scientific concepts by taking them to extremes. So imagine if you were studying a population of people who were all genetically identical. They were all clones. Okay. Now, as geneticists, when we're looking at a behavioral trait, what we're interested in is saying what proportion of the variation in this trait is explained by genetics and what proportion is explained by variation in heritability. And if you look at a population of clones, then none of the variation will be explained by genetics, because the genetics is all the same. So you will only be looking at heritability, the effects of the environment, whatever that actually means. Okay. To turn it round, though, imagine you're raising individuals in a homogeneous environment. Now what becomes apparent is that the only thing that's really important is the variation in genetics. And in fact, we actually see that with height. Okay? The Dutch used to be the tallest, used to be the shortest nation in Europe. The Belgians ridiculed them for it in the 1850s. Okay? There were cartoons published, dwarf Dutch people. And as I'm sure many of you know, the Dutch are now officially the tallest nation on the planet. Okay? Now, this change is not to do with a change in genetics. Okay? Although there's been immigration in the Netherlands, it hasn't actually changed the gene pool remarkably so. So the change in height that we observe, the average male height is 184 centimetres. Okay, I worked in a research institute with two people called Marcel. And one was called Short Marcel, and the other was called Tall Marcel. Short Marcel was 6'6". Tall Marcel was 7'2". And he was one of three people who were over 7 foot amongst the 36 individuals that I worked with. Okay. So what's clearly changed is the environment. At about the 1850s, the Dutch instituted a series of political reforms, and the environment became much more homogeneous, but also, more importantly, diet changed. So the diet became much better, so their natural tendency to become tall was revealed and has gradually continued to be revealed. So this is the problem that we have to deal with if we're going to take genetics into the courts, is that we're not dealing with something precise. We're not dealing with a sort of situation where, such as you often have in diminished responsibility, where a patient behaves abnormally and violent and then is revealed to have a brain tumour, okay, which is corrected by removal of that brain tumour. Genetics doesn't work that way. We cannot split genetics from the environment, and similarly, and because of that, we can't actually make genetics the blame or the specific cause. We can't use genetic determinism, I don't think, in the law courts. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you very much. Robin McKenzie.
You need to tell me where to point this.
Anywhere you like.
Will it work?
Straight up there.
Okay. I'm sorry to say that my particular genetic inheritance doesn't include good sight, so I'm going to have to stand here and point this at my PowerPoints and speak to you from them, rather than read the helpful little screens that are above the exits. So please excuse me. This is me. This is what I'm going to be talking about, how criminal responsibility works in the law. I'll speak a little bit more about the MAOA low allele that we've just had introduced to us. I'll talk about ideas of screening and intervening that are based on the idea that responsibility can be ameliorated by compulsory treatment. And I'll talk about neurodiversity. In terms of criminal responsibility, very, very basically, there's this idea that your body does the bad thing, your mind intends to do the bad thing, so therefore that makes you guilty. You have a guilty mind, you've done the bad thing, and the prosecution has to show that not only was the bad thing done, but you intended to do the bad thing. So in terms of talking about our genes and how that relates to criminal responsibility, then we're talking about a folk psychology that underpins the law that says the body and the mind are separate. So the law consequently has problems when there's something in the body that affects the mind. This means that our way of dealing with our genetic inheritance and our criminal responsibility is not sophisticated, as we've heard. Now, Jonathan told us about the study about what happened in New Zealand, and because you can tell from my voice, I come from New Zealand. These are the examples I'm going to be drawing upon. The study was done in a group of children from the city that I come from in Dunedin, who have been followed for almost 30 years now. And it's been something that the university where I was trained is very, very proud of, because a lot of these studies that have come out of that particular group of children have been really, really helpful. What followed the study a few years later was an attempt to make all sorts of social generalisations from the presence of that particular genetic formation in a different group of people, which is the indigenous population of New Zealand, otherwise known as the Maori, and come out with this. Leon Chambers, who carried out the study a few years after the Caspi team, made a lot of generalisations about, well, if we look at the Maori population, what do we see? We see a great number of convictions for violence. We see a great proportion of people in jail. We see a lot of violence. We see a lot of gambling. We see a lot of risk-taking. Golly, it must be the gene. It can't be the fact that they're an indigenous population who has been subjected to colonisation and racism for quite some time and live in disadvantaged circumstances very often. No, 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 no. So although they said, well, of course you can't say cause and effect very clearly with the genetic formation, in fact, the social assumptions that they were making when they talked about their study did reveal that. And later, Maori scientist with a biochemistry background investigated the study and said, well, actually, if you're looking at 17 Maoris and generalising to a whole population, there are really some problems with that. And you'll discover this with a lot of the studies that come out of this particular area. Enormous generalisations are made from very small samples in a way that really is kind of unsustainable. The other thing is that if you're looking at the Maori, then you're looking at a whole lot of different tribes. So even if you had lots and lots of people from one tribe, trying to generalise to other tribes is going to be difficult. And this is, again, coming back to what Jonathan was saying about replication of genetic studies in particular populations. However, now there's still in New Zealand some talk of trying to perhaps use this kind of evidence to justify some of the things that many of us might worry about, like giving reduced sentences on the basis of genetic inheritance, or deciding, well, okay, if they're dangerous enough to give them a reduced sentence, maybe they're dangerous enough for us to keep them in prison for a long time, perhaps indefinitely. So what I'm talking about is the dangers of making all sorts of social assumptions and political actions on the basis of these studies. And you can see here some stills from a movie which was very, very popular about the Maori. It's called Once We're Warriors, and it was made before all these studies came out. It was a lament for what had happened to an indigenous population that had been treated in a way that few of the colonials would be proud of now. And they're seeking to find a kind of dignity in life in a dispossessed way. However, once all these studies from Leon Chambers came out, it became reread as a golly. Look, here's the warrior gene. They have more of the warrior gene. Therefore, this is why they're acting in the way they do, why they're overrepresented in the jail population and the convictions for violent crime. So I think this whole area is very prone to a kind of mythologizing and an overgeneralization that we in this room today need to be aware of when we think about the topic that we're here to discuss today. Okay, and I think we see this particularly when we're talking about the prospect of finding genetic formations in young people and what we're going to do about it, seeing these as predicting perhaps risk, dangerousness, violent crime in the future. And I'm talking particularly here as an example of children who are diagnosed with callous and emotional conduct disorder who are seen as fledgling psychopaths. And the idea is that if, since there seems to be an element of heredity there, perhaps everyone could be screened, or people, children who are seen as problematic could be screened, subjected to compulsory treatment to make them more like the rest of us. Now, this the rest of us, I would suggest to you, is equally mythological, because I don't think we're all characterised by loving ethical conduct at all times. It would be nice if we were, but that's not how we've evolved, and perhaps it actually wouldn't be all that functional if we were either. However, you can see here that there are ideas that these children should be given special drugs to promote moral enhancement, or perhaps given oxytocin to make them nicer to be around. Because if you look at the evidence for some of the things that go around in our brains, oxytocin is one of them. And it's commonly seen as an empathogenic love hormone. So that you see things in papers like the Daily Mail that say when you stroke your partner, when you have a satisfying sexual relationship, this promotes oxytocin and it makes us a better person. So people now in the caring professions are being encouraged to stroke their clients to promote oxytocin and social bonds. One of the problems with this is if you look a bit deeper into oxytocin, it's not the only thing it does. It works very, very differently if you've had an upbringing where you've been in an atmosphere of loving care, or if you haven't. If you have, then okay, more oxytocin makes you feel better and behave in a way that could be seen as loving care. If not, then it doesn't work. And the other thing is, what it tends to do is promote what's called tend and defend behaviour, where you look after the people you're close to and you reject all the others who are not in your in-group. So actually this idea that it's going to promote wider social bonds is a bit difficult. The other thing is, if we look at people who are different and we look at them in terms of moral judgment, then one of the ways of looking at children who are characterised with callous and emotional conduct disorder is that they're subject to a condition where they're not sensitive to their own emotions, and that makes it difficult for them to be sensitive to the emotions of others. And this in itself isn't something that should necessarily be morally condemned or subjected to compulsory treatment. I want to finish by thinking about neurodiversity, which is the idea that how the law should treat people who are different is something that's got an ethical dimension, a political dimension, and a social dimension, which is really important. The criminal justice system doesn't respond particularly well to difference. If we look at the case of Gary McKinnon, who, as I'm sure you all know, hacked into the US defense computers and was seen as having done criminal damage that he could have been extradited from Britain and put into prison for quite some time. He did it, he says, because he wanted to investigate contacts made with aliens. And so he was doing it with a higher moral purpose rather than doing it with this idea that he was engaging in criminal activity. Well, is it right that he should be taken away and shut up in a foreign country on those grounds, no matter what the results of it were? Most of the results were that the he'd fiddled with passwords and so on, and the US Defense Department had to fix that somehow. So that's one kind of difference. Another kind of difference is psychopathy. And I think, you know, there's a cultural fascination with psychopathy for obvious reasons. And one of the issues here is if we know the difference between right and wrong, we're commonly seen as being competent to stand trial. That's a cognitive way of looking at things. Insofar as you can separate the cognitive and the emotional, if you don't care about whether you're doing right and wrong, are you, in fact, different in a way that the legal system should take into account? I've called my talk, "The Genes Made Me Do It." There's a lot of cases that come to court at the moment saying, "My brain made me do it." Okay? I have all these characteristics that turn up in tests for psychopathy. Therefore, I didn't have free choice about what I'm doing. And this is something that's going to become increasingly presented before the courts as evidence. And it's something that we need to consider now about how that should relate to criminal responsibility, because it's not straightforward. And these are the kind of questions we have. If we're looking at why people are put into jail, it's not simply to punish them for the crime. It's not necessarily so that they can get better because they're going to be rehabilitated. Most of those diagnosed with psychopathy, in fact, don't get better. And they've got a very high rate of being put back in prison. So do we have a right as a society to shut away people indefinitely to protect us from them? Well, increasingly countries are saying, yes, we do. So are the dangerous genes or are the flawed assumptions? If we look at the MAOA allele that we've been talking about, if you look at it in men, it has one effect. If you look at it in women, you can see that on a 30-year study of all these subjects, the women, despite every possible variable that you can think of, were happier if they had that gene. So the idea that we should rid humanity of that gene because it's associated with violence in some men is problematic, because a lot of us women would be less happy. That's not what we want. And women who had the different allele of the particular gene, in fact, could be more aggressive in some circumstances. And if you look at the... this, again, is bearing out what Jonathan says. Systematic meta-analyses of genetic associations haven't borne out this idea that there's something we can reliably say there's a genetic formation associated with violence. So here are the dangers. Genetic determinism leading to screening and compulsory interventions. Stigma based on things that are wider social causes rather than your genes. Oversimplification of genetic data. And laws which really shouldn't be passed on the basis of genetic data. This is my final slide. What I'm saying is we need to think about the kind of society we want. And I think we need to think about the society we've got without engaging in the kind of myth that says actually we're all nice, cuddly people. And everyone should be an all nice, cuddly people. This is the thought from George Orwell. Men can be highly civilized only while other men, inevitably less civilized, are there to guide and feed them. So unless we're protected by these particular guardians, then, you know, what value has our life and how are we going to respond to difference in this light? Okay, thank you.
Right, so I'm Tom Baldwin, and I think I can read the screen that's up there. So I'm a professor of philosophy, which doesn't really qualify me for talking about this, but I did contribute to this Nuffield bioethics report called Genetics and Human Behaviour. It's now 10 years old. And I rather drew on that when thinking about this topic. It's been very unnerving for me, coming third and not knowing at all what the other two speakers were going to say. I can see I've made one mistake in what I've written, I've put up, but anyway, only one. But there is a remarkable coherence in some points. Okay, I want to start by just thinking about the topic, genetics and criminal justice. Now, genetics is a branch of biology. The criminal justice system is a social institution. So how do you yoke biology and a social institution? In a way, as Ian said, you know, we're talking about science and society, but still, there needs to be some bridge. So in this context, the bridge comes partly from words like behavior, behavioral, in that if there are genetic predispositions to certain types of behavior, and these are types of behavior which turn out to be of particular interest and importance for the criminal justice system, then in a way we can see how the connection can be made, particularly where, in fact, what the genetics typically does is offer us evidence or suggest that there is evidence to support predispositions to particular types of behavior. And what Jonathan precisely focused on is the slightly narrow evidence that there is in this area. Now, I just picked out two. Psychopathy, which Robin also mentioned, is known to be strongly heritable from twin studies, and that suggests that there is some genetic basis for some genetic predisposition for it. This is where I made my mistake. I also say a little about the MAOH variant of that gene, which I place on the Y chromosome, but I realize that's a mistake. Okay, but I did get to know Hans Brunner a little, so yes, he was the person who identified it from a Dutch family, the male, most but not all of the male members of which had a terrible tendency, a predisposition to extremely violent, aggressive behavior, particularly towards women. There was a long history of sexual violence, I'm afraid. Just one other thing. Actually, the Y chromosome itself is quite strongly associated with criminal behavior. You just have to think about the population, the prison population in this country. Okay. But, and now here I agree with both the previous speakers, further work on this MAOA gene indicates that all sorts of things other than just the gene itself make a difference to the predisposition to these forms of violence. In particular, a history of childhood abuse seems to make a big difference. And the moral that we need to get in our heads very quickly here, which the other speakers have both already emphasized, is that it's a bad mistake to subscribe to a doctrine that's got called, standardly called now, genetic exceptionalism, which is to think that somehow genetics is a completely superior form of predictive evidence about subsequent life. No. Genetics is, as Jonathan rightly said, genetics is one source of evidence. The environment, and in particular the early childhood environment, is another source of evidence. And, you know, it's up for grabs, which in a particular case is more important. Okay, so that's the sort of, seems to be the evidential background. So now how does this, in particular focusing in on the criminal justice system, what's the point at which these stories, speculative in some respects, about genetic predispositions to extremely violent behavior, make contact in detail with the criminal justice system? And the answer is the one that Robin gave. It comes through the mens rea requirement of criminal responsibility, which I cashed out here in a slightly tendentious way with the thought that the agent's performance of an act which is prima facie criminal, that act should in some way manifest a free will, that it should be something that the agent intended to do or recklessly foresaw would be an outcome of what they were doing. Now, it's then easy to see how to argue that acts which manifest very strong predispositions fail to satisfy this mens rea requirement, because on the face of it, if these acts can be explained by reference to genetic predispositions, then since these predispositions are obviously not chosen in any way by the agent, the acts which issue from them don't manifest the agent's free will at all, so it would be unfair to attribute criminal responsibility to them for the actions which come about that way. So, let's keep going, I think. So, and this then is the prima facie argument. So the relevance of genetics to the criminal justice system, okay, is that it underpins the thought that where a prima facie criminal act arises from a predisposition to something like very aggressive, violent behavior, the act doesn't express the agent's free will, and it's therefore improper, unfair, to treat the agent as responsible for what they did. Okay, that's the line of argument. Okay, I'm now going to kick away at it a bit. In thinking about it, certainly we should start by saying that some people have the misfortune to have these very powerful predispositions of this kind. And I take it that neither of the other speakers wanted to call that into question. But the issue that remains to be settled is whether where you have a predisposition of that kind and it issues in something that you do, it's clear that you didn't control the predisposition, but is it so clear that the predisposition was uncontrollable? There's a slide from not controlled to uncontrollable if we're to get to violate the requirement for criminal responsibility. Okay, and that brings us to the can of worms known as the free will problem. Okay, now look, we all, and here I have to go very sketchily. So we all have certain capacities and motivations which are deeply rooted in our character by our genes, by our early experiences, and the rest. So the issue now is this. By analogy with the previous line of thought, given that we have these deeply rooted predispositions, does it follow that we too can't be held responsible for our own behavior? And the answer to that must be no. Because these capacities precisely include capacities for understanding what's going on, for understanding ourselves, for reflecting upon ourselves, for deliberation, and for choice. And these are the capacities which enable us to take control of our motivations and integrate them into the conduct of a life of our own. And it's these capacities which precisely constitute a free will. Of having a free will is having capacities which provide one with the ability to appreciate reasons for and against different courses of action and to act in the light of those reasons. So to have a free will is to be a rational agent. It's to be someone whose actions are explained by the reasons which justify them. So the normative reasons which justify the agent in doing what he or she did are also the explanation of why they did what they did. Now, a free will, understood this way, is not a supernatural power to project yourself somehow beyond nature. We are not supernatural beings. We are great apes with some very remarkable natural capacities for understanding, reflection, deliberation, and self-constitution. So, given that view of what free will is, and given that genetics provides us precisely with the capacities and abilities which underpin free will, genetics doesn't in any way threaten the attribution of responsibility. Instead, it may help us to understand the biological basis, but it doesn't undermine it. So the conclusion I draw then is that having deeply rooted dispositions and capacities isn't a knockdown argument against criminal responsibility. On the contrary, criminal responsibility requires it. However, what we have also to recognize is that these very capacities, which are characteristic of free action and free will, can be damaged. Notoriously, they can be damaged by traumatic incidents and adversely affected by mental illnesses. And the criminal justice system has a very long experience of these issues and their implications. And here's the example, classic example from English law. It's from the 14th century that postnatal depression has been recognized as a reason for mitigating criminal responsibility where a mother kills her child. So there's nothing new about this. So now, come back to the question of what genetics adds here. On the face of it, understanding these capacities, where they're damaged and where they're not, belongs to psychiatry and clinical psychology. So the question now is, does genetics have much to add? Well, it's a familiar fact that mental illness is strongly heritable, so there's no doubt a significant genetic contribution to its explanation and to that of other mental disorders, including antisocial personality disorder. But I myself, and here I don't know if I do disagree with the previous speakers, I doubt if genetics adds very much to psychology and psychiatry. Because the central question in a particular case for the criminal justice system is whether someone's mental condition is such that at the crucial time, time of action, they were not in a position to control a powerful motivation, whether this was aggression or despair or some other motivation. Now, a genetics which teaches about probabilities and predispositions is simply not in a position to give a helpful answer to that question. Now, that's not an objection or criticism of genetics, it's just to point to the fact that genetics doesn't answer the question that comes up in the courtroom. Insofar as there are answers to that question, they come from psychologists and psychiatrists, it seems to me. Okay, now very briefly now, to the end. As Robin mentioned, there are one or two other contexts in which genetics comes in. Can we rely on evidence of genetic predispositions to justify early interventions of the kind that you mentioned? Well, my own view, I mean, not going into the details that Robin went into, is that it would be obviously very unjust to set aside presumptions of innocence and detain an innocent person, particularly a child, against their will. But that, I take it, is no reason for not offering or encouraging genuinely beneficial interventions. And you've said and asked about oxytocin for us to wonder what kind of intervention that is. But a different kind of intervention is anger management. So if you have someone who has already shown extreme aggression, then anger management is probably a useful form of behavior therapy. It's certainly something worth trying, and you can try to persuade such a person that this would be good for them. So I see no objection to encouraging people, but I see strong objection to kinds of detention and forcing them upon them. The other context in which people think about using genetics in the criminal justice system is when it comes to sentencing. Because in the course of sentencing someone who's been convicted, then there needs to be an overall assessment of the needs of the offender and the kind of regime that's likely to help them turn their life around. And there's good reason to think that genetics might help one in an assessment of this kind, though it seems to me that psychiatry and psychology are going to help you much more. So my position, I'm afraid, is largely sceptical. Right, so that's where I end.
Okay. Thank you all very much. I hope you all don't mind if I ask the first question, is that you've all presented quite a picture of sort of nuanced and difficult evidence balancing in different ways between psychiatry and genetics, and particularly when we apply this to the criminal courts. The judiciary and politicians tend not to have a particularly strong scientific background and tend to be more swayed by things like the Daily Mail than perhaps science than they ought to be. So do you think there's a minimum level of scientific knowledge that judges and politicians ought to try to attain, and how do you think that could be achieved, if so?
Well, I think scientific, yes, a more scientifically literate political class would be a good thing. I'm not sure how you'd achieve that. I mean, encourage more scientists to become politicians. I mean, it's funny. I think science and politics they're not easy bedfellows. So I'm not sure. But I think certainly there are going to be more instances where the courts will encounter genetics, and they will have to know, should we include this? How reliable is the evidence? But then I guess they've encountered scientific evidence before. You have an expert witness. And then it falls down to the expert witness, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I have had some dealings with members of the judiciary involved in intellectual property cases, in particular in cases of patenting DNA. And actually, my sense is that the members of the judiciary who deal with that are extremely well informed. Mm. And the key judgments by people like Lord Hoffman are actually fantastic pieces of good science writing. So I think the issue is important, but my experience is that, at least in the English legal system, judges make an effort. I think if you read the US Supreme Court decision on the Myriad case, you do slightly, I'm afraid I do, slightly scratch my head about what was going on in the minds of those who were writing that judgment.
Yes. Robin?
Yeah. I think it's incumbent upon us all, not just the judges and the politicians, to acquire a degree of scientific literacy, but also what Tom finished with, a sceptical mind. I think a sceptical mind is something that is essential for all of us in these times. Not just in terms of science, in terms of politics, certainly.
Okay, so questions from the gallery. Gentleman on the front right here.
Thank you all three for some very interesting presentations. But I'm still puzzled. Am I any less responsible, any more responsible for the environmental influences on me? And if supposing I lack the capacities on which the last speaker has been mentioning, am I somehow responsible for that any more so than if I have a certain genetic predisposition? In other words, is there any justification for having any criminal justice system at all, or for blaming anybody for anything, or for praising anybody for anything?
Shall I answer that, I think? Okay, I mean, obviously, you're quite right about, you know, early childhood. Obviously, you didn't choose your early childhood, so you can't be held responsible for that. Nor can you be held responsible for the acquisition or a failure to acquire the capacities which I identified as, in a sense, constitutive of free will. But most human beings develop those capacities in the course of childhood and adolescence. So most people have those capacities, so most people are capable of a sufficient degree of deliberation, self-understanding, and self-control to lead lives for which they can be held responsible. Now, the point is that you become responsible by exercising the capacities. And as you, point made by Aristotle, as you develop and exercise capacities, you modify them. And so, in a sense, you become responsible for the capacities that you've acquired without responsibility as you lead your ordinary life, as you deliberate.
For that, am I responsible if I don't
modify? Well, if you stay as a, you know, an infant who screams and shouts, yes, you're not responsible, but that's a pretty wretched life you're going to lead. But, of course, there are very handicapped people whose lives, very sadly, you know, perhaps don't progress much beyond that. But then they, leading these terrible lives, are quite rightly held not responsible for what they do. But your life is completely different. Because you're standing up, you've come here, you've asked an intelligent question. These are skills.
Another intelligent question, please. lady on the front row over there.
I'm a psychiatrist. First point is whether or not scientists make good politicians or could be politicians. In China, most politicians are in fact engineers, and it's only a parochial view that isn't the way to become a politician. But my point is really a practical point. In this country, it's quite well known, in fact, that if you would like diminished responsibility and you have enough money, you can employ a psychologist or a psychiatrist to say almost anything. There's a real problem with monitoring and controlling that. And I think that there are some people known who will say more lenient things than others. And I think psychiatrists in general should only be able to appear in court a certain number of times each year to try and control some people profiteering out of that.
Sorry, could I just ask, shouldn't that presumably these psychiatrists are working with an evidence base? So if they come to a decision, they're actually making a scientifically based decision, one that would withstand peer review, or is that not the case?
It's not how it works.
Huh. Rob, do you want to comment on that, Robbie?
We have a professor of law here. Robin, could I ask, is that how it works? Or?
I hesitate to comment on your knowledge in this field because, you know, in terms of expert witnesses, many of them have fallen off their perches. You know, once upon a time we thought an expert witness was an expert witness, and in fact they claim to have this expertise. On subsequent inquiry, it has appeared that, in fact, the claims that they're making can't be justified. So I think more regulation of and quality control in that area undoubtedly would be a good thing. Thank you.
Okay. Next question. Gentleman on third row.
Hi. Well, basically, if I'm worried that if you label children as psychopathic, that you're basically enabling yourself or labelling them to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. And if that's the case, how do you really say whether it's fair or not to blame them for their behaviours if you're already labelling them as such in the first place?
Robin,
I think that
you.
I need to say that I don't think that it's fair to label children as psychopaths at all. Some of them are seen as fledgling psychopaths. I would tend to see this in terms of emotional hypo or hypersensitivity. Some children are very, very sensitive to emotional stimuli. They quite often have what's called a negative attribution bias that means that they see threats where they're not intended, and they react aggressively. And this is where, you know, offering programs like anger management, like appropriate, accurate identification of others' intentions can be, I think, extremely helpful without necessarily labelling them as the fledgling psychopaths. I think that...
so on and so forth, and what's happening within that system. So, like, I mean, I've been in my experience, I've been around children that have this kind of label culture where, you know, they do find that they've been labelled a certain thing and then they perpetuate that label throughout their whole childhood, no matter whether they try and been helped through anger management or counselling or whatever services are available to them at that moment in time, you know, and they generally are limited in their own right. The simple label itself causes some of the big problems for them.
I think it's very difficult to deal with this area without bringing in the whole thing about labelling and stigma, because as soon as there is a label, it's going to be stigmatising. If we look at the whole way that people who we now see as, we describe them as learning disabled, then there's been a whole range of terms like special, like handicapped, that have ended up being stigmatized. So how we deal with children who could do with some help or being offered some help without stigmatizing them is a huge social issue, I agree with you. And it's an ethical issue, it's a political issue. I don't think it's right to force children to have compulsory treatment. I think it is right to offer them help in a non-stigmatizing way and to manage the offering of the help in that light.
Are they not eventually, if it comes to down to a criminal justice system, that, you know, if they've basically been kicked in the teeth from the start, so to speak?
A lot of children are kicked in the teeth right from the start. And it's not just by labelling, it's by the social circumstances that they've been brought up in, their family environment. It's a delicate ethical issue how you go about helping these people without stigmatising them. And I think as a society it's something we need to contemplate very carefully. What we've spoken about today is how far genetics enables us to do this in a sensitive fashion. It would seem that people with the MAOAL allele are, because they're more sensitive to environment, more able to be helped by changing the environmental variables. So, in a sense, not offering them help is unethical. Yeah.
Okay. Gentleman in the sixth row, in the green.
Hello. Have there been any studies done on class-based criminality? I'm thinking of, you know, the concentration of a gene, for example, in the underclass or indeed the upper class. I mean, we've all seen, you know, Inspector Morse or Agatha Christie, and the upper classes are always murdering each other willy-nilly. I mean, is there a gene there?
Sorry, are you asking if there's a gene for upper-class criminal behaviour or...?
I'm asking, rather than looking at different tribes or, you know, nations, have there been studies of, you know, within, for example, Britain, as a classic example, you know, we know there is an underclass, we know there is an upper class, we know that they have bred with each other for hundreds of years, and that's in many ways why the underclass cannot escape from the underclass, and equally so, the upper class won't drop down to the rest of us. So, is there a genetic factor there? Has any studies been done on this?
Quite sure how to answer that. So, in terms of heritability for anything that you want to look at, as I said, the genetics becomes really important when the environment is homogenous. So, where you have very, very stratified society, actually the environment is much more important than genetics. Because the variability across the population is much more... So where you have huge disparities in socioeconomic conditions, then those will be much more important than genetics is. What's really interesting is when there's been very limited studies in this area, but the ones that have been done have compared the UK and the US to Scandinavian countries. And what's really interesting is when you look in Scandinavian countries where the environment really is a lot more homogenous. And these were studies looking at IQ, and they were also looking at specific learning mechanisms. Genetics was more important in the Scandinavian population than it was in the US or the British one, which supports the idea that, that when you homogenize the environment, when everybody has the same advantage, then the variation in genetics becomes important. I don't know whether that answers your question or whether. No,
I mean, not really, because I mean, you must have heard of the studies of Charles and Murray, for example. You know, identifying the American and English underclass and
The bell curve,
very controversial stuff, and suggesting that indeed it is genetic, and which explains one of the reasons why the underclass can never escape from being an underclass.
Oh,
and I would argue equally the upper class.
Right, right. There's absolutely no evidence to suggest that that's true. That's almost a kind of Victorian viewpoint. I mean, I think Francis Galton might even have balked at supposing that. I can't think anybody's ever done any studies like that anyway, but the genetics, you wouldn't expect that to happen anyway. As you say, populations are homogenous. So I mean, it's true that wealth appears to be heritable, but we know why. We know why it's heritable.
Lady in the back row there in the stripes. Sorry. Wait for a moment. The microphone will get to you in the end.
So I just wanted to ask, if nature and nurture are sort of, it's impossible to separate their influence, are we then going to see a legal system which is increasingly personalised on people's own case histories and their childhood and their genetics? And is that tenable or even fairer than a more generalised system that we have at the moment?
What happens at the moment is, as I say, you know, the body did the action, the guilty mind intended or was reckless about the bad thing that was done. What happens at the beginning of the court is establishing whether the person is guilty according to the law. What happens next is where a lot of the individual circumstances often come in. So it's a mitigation of sentence. Classically, the defence lawyer will stand up and say, OK, my client did this, my client is guilty according to the law, but I would argue that they shouldn't be sentenced to the full extent of the law because of all these factors. And it's possible that genes could come in there. At the moment, the my genes made it do it defence has not done very well. And I think you've probably gathered that none of us think that it should.
Would you get a psychiatrist to come along?
Maybe in the fourth row. Psychiatrists
are great,
by the way. your question, please.
Hi. I would argue that actually, if your genes make you do it, then you actually should be locked up to save society, really. The reason people are locked up is to protect the rest of the population. So if your genes made you do it, you should be locked up. At the same time, the genes made you do it thing, like Jonathan said, your environment is much more important. Class is important. Where you live is important. If you're in a state full of gangs, you're much more likely to end up a criminal just because of where you are, not anything to do with genetics. So yeah, if we did, society should be more responsible, maybe in looking after children at a young age, like maybe doing more to like help children, child benefits probably more important. Testing them probably is important, even if it kind of produces a stigma, at least they're getting help for their genetic predisposition. And on most of these cases, like the 2002 case, they showed that nurture, like a good, warm, loving environment as a kid, means you grow up not to be a criminal or not likely to be a criminal. So based on that alone, we should be doing more to look after children and prevent them from growing up to be criminals.
I think that there's no question at all that trying to reduce social problems to genetic formations is an ethical can of worms, as well as unjustifiable intellectually. I think that more money and more resources and more thought should undoubtedly be going into everybody's early years to enable us all to become better citizens. The idea that my genes made me do it so I should be shut up is one of the perils that often stops people pleading things like insanity or whatever, because if you have a criminal sentence, then you shut up for a certain amount of time normally. If you have one of those other sentences that says, oh, well, you know, there's something different about me that meant that I couldn't control myself, then the likelihood that you're going to be shut up for much longer becomes much stronger. Right. So people are reluctant to make those kinds of pleas in that light, apart from your ones who get this nice little truncated bit of diminished responsibility.
Lady in the fourth row here, if you could just pass the microphone along that way, that would be great. Thanks.
Thank you, that was fascinating.
there was a not so long ago, there was a case of a woman who, and I forget the name, who was accused and jailed, and eventually the appeal court freed her after killing her child. And that was based on expert evidence, mm-hmm. which turned out to be fallacious, because the expert had extrapolated from a probability to a definite, this is what must have happened. And I think that's a real danger in this field, which is obviously fairly new. And I think politicians do try to find evidence on which to base their policies. As a local politician and one-time scientist, I can attest to that. But surely the issue here is that all this information, the science, the evidence, can lead not to excuse the behaviour, but to lead to some indications as to how that person may be treated to modify their behaviour. And the particular question I would like to ask is there ever any genetic evidence in respect of alcoholism?
For the specific gene I was talking about, or just in general?
I'm aware that there is there is a gene identified associated, for instance, with marijuana psychosis. Uh-huh. And the alcoholism does seem to run in families but not affect everybody, which is prima facie case, you know?
Well, twin studies, which is the usual method of looking to see whether there's a contribution, genetics makes a contribution to anything. There are regions of the genome which are clearly associated with alcoholism. Or at least, if you're an identical twin and you are alcoholic, your identical twin is much more likely to be an alcoholic than if you were just brother and sister. So genetics plays a role. But then it's actually quite hard to find something that humans do where genetics doesn't play a role. Learning a specific language is about the only one that people have been able to come up with. Intervention is sort of trickier. What's interesting is that monoamine oxidase inhibitors are used to treat depression. So clearly, clearly lowering the levels of monoamine oxidase in substantial proportions of the population is not causing this huge epidemic of aggressive criminality. and it's often, in fact, that's often used as an evidence to sort of say, well, maybe this is not the gene we're looking for anyway. Mm-hmm.
So. Does it depend on where the monoamine oxidase happens to be active in the body? Because, you know, there's barriers at various points.
The drugs are designed to actually lower it in the brain, which is where the genes are supposed to be functioning to.
New people up on the balcony, there is a microphone with you as well, so feel free to put your hands up. But for now, let's see, gentleman near the back with, looks like it has headphones on his T-shirt. right, okay, I will take him next. Thank you.
Thank you for the talk, and I would like to ask, I think there's quite a lot of studies on the MAOAL genes, which are the warrior genes, but I'm just wondering that is it possible, there's a possibility that these genes has, the people which have these genes have a higher possibility to have violent actions or more have aggressions because they are labeled to have these warrior genes. And this become one of the environmental factors which causing that. And if
usually the people only get to the studies after they've already shown the aggressive tendencies, so they wouldn't know that they would have this. Which variant it was.
But it will still be. But will it be strange that we are just trying to find within a group of people find some sort of genes which seems to be causing them to have violent action, but it doesn't really show that there is some sort of really chemical reaction which causing them?
No, I think that's actually probably fairly true. For all the evidence from behavioral genetics, we can see an association between a particular gene variant and a particular trait. We have absolutely no idea about what's going on at the biochemical level or the cellular level.
So it's just like a statistical way to
find. Yes, that's exactly what it is.
Okay, thank you very much.
Up on the balcony.
Thank you. I don't know if any of the panel has seen the reports in The Guardian last week about Michael Gove's advisor saying that about 70% of school achievements attributable to genetics. Not only did I find that claim a little bit nauseating, but as a science teacher, I thought I might be out of a job soon because apparently what I'm doing is pointless.
Sorry, I didn't quite get the question. Could you?
Yeah, I don't know if any of the panel could comment on the fact that Michael Gove, the Secretary of State's advisor, Dominic Cummins, claimed that 70% of school success is attributable to genetics and not quality of education.
Well, you should all read the Telegraph today, because it's not a plug.
Certainly should.
Steve Jones has actually written a fantastic article, which essentially says what I'm going to say, which is that, and in fact, I've already sort of said it, if you want to improve the education, then relying on genetics is ludicrous. Unless you're living in a society where everybody has equal opportunity, complete equal opportunity, then maybe you can start addressing the genetics. But until you do that, the environment will be much more important. So the social inequalities, access to good education. So improving. Ironically, by focusing on genetics, he's actually sort of been hoisted by his own petard, because genetics will tell you, get the environment right first, because that will be the important thing. And also, studies in IQ have shown very clearly that the key thing that improves people's IQ is improved education and improved experience. Genetics hasn't changed over the period of time when we've been observing the so-called Flynn effect, which is this enormous jump in IQ at each generation. The gene pool hasn't significantly changed, so the only thing that could have changed is the environment. Sorry, rant over.
Again, on the balcony, a lady in the middle.
Hi. I think my question kind of starts with the fact of predisposition versus predetermination of character and behaviours. Just because you might have a genetic predisposition towards a certain tendency in your behaviours doesn't necessarily mean that's the cause. For example, we get things in biology in cancers where you might have a disposition towards breast cancer, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you will get it. Normal people, sorry to use the phrase, who don't necessarily have this genetic mutation on an allele or what have you, they still do bad things. They're still in prison too. So just because someone might have a predisposition towards it, what if they just did it because they kind of fancied it for a bit of a jolly rather than, and could we lock them up indefinitely, even though that wasn't the causing factor of why they did what they were locked up for in the first place?
Yes, I mean, I think that's exactly right. It's a statistical phenomenon. The 30% of Caucasian men have this variant that has been associated with the original Caspi study with aggression. That's a significant proportion of the population who aren't in prison for criminal activity. So, yeah, I think I agree with you about this idea of predetermination and predisposition. I don't think we could be as strong as that. I think with the breast cancer mutations, yes, we can sort of say, because the statistical effects are so strong. With this, they're not.
Okay, I'm going to have to say the last two questions now, one of which will be this gentleman here.
With five more babies born than people die every 2 seconds, can we afford these niceties?
He's what?
With five more babies born than people die every 2 seconds, which is the equivalent of the population of London every 5 weeks, can we afford these niceties of distinguishing motives for criminal behaviour?
I would have thought that it's even more important when you have more people.
I can't see the connection. I mean, we're all right. Human population is increasing enormously, as you've described. I can't see why that's a reason for calling into question the system of criminal responsibility.
Okay, last question, please. Lady on the fourth row.
Hi. Some of you were talking about the criminal courts and that the first thing they want to establish is that you've done the bad action and that you have a guilty mind. You've suggested that that's not necessarily adequate because it seems to separate the mind from the body, and it leads you to these unintuitive phrases like, my genes made me do it, which we all sense there's something wrong with, and my brain made me do it, which we sense there's even more wrong with that. Do you have a suggestion of a procedure that would be more helpful and that takes account what this gentleman was explaining about understanding our capacity for choice in terms of the capacities we have as human beings who are people with bodies?
I think all I can say is that the law is always a work in progress. The Law Commission at the minute is looking at situations within which someone may be seen as less blameworthy because of some bodily condition that so far hasn't been incorporated into the law. In terms of the genetics, obviously we don't know enough about it at the moment to make any of these kinds of generalisations. But the reason that we're here now is so that we can think of these things if the state of knowledge, or should I say when the state of knowledge, becomes such that our ability to make predictions, to talk about cause, rather more than at the moment what all we can talk about is correlation, statistical associations, how that relates to the individual is very, very difficult to pinpoint. So if it ever becomes possible to pinpoint, you would need to speak about this, but we're sceptical, mm-hmm. Then if we've worked out, if we've considered the ethics of a lot of the courses of actions that politicians are likely to promote, like, you know, our lovely Mr. Gove, then we're in a better position to exercise scepticism. And I think that's undoubtedly a good thing in this area.
Can I just add something? That, I mean, although Robin talked about body and mind as if, you know, you had to think in those terms, actually, what the law is pointing to is that actions, all our actions admit of endlessly many descriptions. So you tread on somebody else's foot. You can do it by accident or you can do it deliberately. And it's that distinction that the law is interested in, which is not really a body-mind distinction. It's whether the description by accident or deliberately applies.
So it's the guilty mind.
So
did you have
feel
a guilty mind?
That is still adequate as an approach?
Do I think it's adequate?
Just curious.
Yes.
Or whether the things you've raised tonight mean a different approach is needed?
Gosh, well, look, there is a very deep question about why the notion of responsibility has the place that it has, not only in the legal system, but in our moral thought. That actually goes a long way, and we didn't really talk about that at all. I think, myself, I would defend it. There are, you know, scientists who would be very sceptical about it, but I think they're mistaken. But I think we have another conversation there, perhaps.
And I think what we're looking at is the law developing into a more nuanced appreciation, because the separation of the mind and the body that I was talking about, it's a folk psychology. It's not based on science. It's not based on nuanced ethical debate of the kind that we've just heard Tom engage in. So putting all these things together is, as I say, a work in progress. Thank you.
Okay. And with that, we have to finish. So thank you all very much for your attendance. Thank you for our panel, Jonathan Pettit, Robin McKenzie and Tom Baldwin.